This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. President Bush is traveling through Africa amid growing pressure to commit American peacekeepers to Liberia. Though the president has yet to decide on a course of action, there is already a team of U.S. military experts on the ground in the war-torn country to assess how the United States can help the situation. Even this preliminary step reflects a profound evolution in the president's feelings about peacekeeping. President Bush brought a pronounced skepticism of such operations into office. But the connection between failed states and global terrorism has challenged those who have historically endorsed a hands-off policy toward international hotspots. We want to hear from you this hour. Under what circumstances do you support committing American troops to peacekeeping efforts? How would the likelihood of casualties affect your opinion? Is peacekeeping the right role for the American military? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the hour, we'll speak in detail about racial equality in South Africa, but first, peacekeeping. What is it, where is it happening, and should America be involved? Joining us for the discussion is Bill Dirch. He's a senior associate at the Henry L. Stimson Center. That's an institute devoted to pursuing global security and peace. And he's joining us by phone from his office here in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Bill.
Hi, Lynn. You're welcome.
Now, Bill, while the president has said that the United States is willing to work with the United Nations and African countries in order to restore peace in Liberia, he's yet to decide about committing any peacekeeping troops there. What is the case, first of all, for America to send peacekeepers to Liberia?
Well, the Liberia conflict has been on and off since 1989, and over that time it has managed to, I think, spread conflict to its neighboring states in serial fashion. Charles Taylor, when he was a rebel, instigated the founding of the Revolutionary United Front in neighboring Sierra Leone, primarily, I think, to get a hold of the diamonds in the fields that border Liberia to fund his own insurgency. And the RUF, as they called it, went on to become one of the most brutal insurgencies in modern times, mutilating thousands of Liberian Sierra Leonean civilians in the election period of 96 and later in 98-99. So it became such a brutal war that, in fact, Taylor has been indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal in Sierra Leone for war crimes and is liable to be arrested if he leaves the country. Cote d'Ivoire, next door to Liberia, also used to be a fairly stable place and is now embroiled in its own civil war. So these things have a tendency to spread and cause displacement and a lot of suffering. And to spread if you don't kind of check them one way or another. And there were several peacekeeping forces in Liberia in the 90s to try and do that, primarily from the economic community of West African states, who are volunteering to send a force back into Liberia today.
Well, why has this the pressure to send peacekeepers in from the United States, why has that intensified so much at this moment? Is it because of the indictment of Charles Taylor? Have events just sort of gone from there?
Well, I think the indictment of Taylor is kind of a trigger. There's also the president's trip to Africa, his first trip to the continent. And so there would be some expectation. These kinds of trips always are used as deadlines to trigger decisions. So there are those things. There is the fact that our allies have done some peacekeeping on their own in Africa, the Brits in Sierra Leone to help stabilize it 2-3 years ago and training their army, the French to help stabilize the ceasefire line in Cote d'Ivoire, and also sending a battalion of troops to lead a small multinational force in a very unstable part of the Congo. U.S. has a kind of special relationship to Liberia because the country as a country was founded by expatriate American ex-slaves in the mid-19th century, and so there's this tie back to the U.S. The Americo-Liberian and local population relationship has been a restive one ever since, with the Americo-Liberians until, say, like 1980 or so, in charge of the politics of the country. And it's been kind of unstable ever since. Anyway, so there's this kind of unique heritage, I guess, that the United States can claim also back to Liberia. But that's also a way of limiting our involvement in peacekeeping in Africa to this place where we have this special relationship.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about peacekeeping, the broader mandate for peacekeeping. What are the origins of peacekeeping as an international military mission?
Well, the modern definition and history traces back to the partition of Palestine in 1948 and the Indo-Pakistani War over Kashmir in 1948-49. Those were the first UN observer missions sent out with soldiers unarmed to monitor ceasefire lines. And that evolved through the 1950s and 60s into what was called the Middle East model, which also focused on interstate conflict. First armed peacekeepers went into the Sinai after the Suez War in 1956 to monitor Israeli, French, and British withdrawals. There's a similar force in Cyprus that's been there since 1964, a force in Lebanon, and a force in the Golan Heights between Syria and Israel. Now, those traditional forces have been in place for a long time because what they're doing is monitoring ceasefires. There is no political agreement that would allow them to leave, that would get rid of the underlying political problems. So that the history, the image of traditional peacekeeping is one of a very long-term prospect. Other operations, though, after the end of the Cold War, began to deal more with internal wars and implementing their settlements, not suppressing the conflict, which we'll get back to in a minute, but implementing agreements that the local parties have come to after they've been sick to death of fighting. So Mozambique or Namibia or Nicaragua or El Salvador all had short-term peacekeeping operations that were kind of confidence-building measures of the sort that, you know, I'll lay down my gun if you do, I'll take the next step if you will, and somebody's there kind of watching and noting it for the international community and with, in some cases, the ability to enforce the peace.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that piece of it, because it's enforcing the peace where it seems to me to be the gray area or the place where problems sometimes occur. How much power, how much authority do these missions have to, quote, enforce the peace?
Right. It depends on the situation and the mission. Where the UN itself got into trouble in the mid-90s, I should say that the Security Council got the UN into trouble. The Council would pass resolutions and then tell the Secretariat to go find the troops to carry them out. And what they did was to put the system into live civil wars rather than situations of implementing peace agreements. So Bosnia, live civil war. Somalia, basically live civil war. Or implementing a peace agreement that not everybody agreed to. This is where it gets kind of tricky. Okay, you've got an agreement, but what are the real motives of the signatories? And can you bring them back to supporting peace if they stray or, in fact, run off with the diamonds, as the case was in Angola, where one side had oil revenues, the other side had diamonds, and if the peace didn't go their way, they went back to fighting. So when we were putting together the Brahimi Report for the UN 3 years ago that I worked with, we said, look, if the Security Council, if you guys on the Security Council are going to ask the international community to do peacekeeping in these kind of tough situations, give them the mandate, let them have the forces that they need to do the job right. Otherwise, it's kind of counterproductive. Why send a force out that can be kicked around by, you know, half a dozen guerrillas on a bridge? And there is this, as you say, large gray area between this kind of be able to defend yourself and your mandate if the situation goes bad, and the kind of situation, let's say, with NATO and Kosovo, where you want to stop the slaughter of innocents, in which case you need an army, you need an air force, you need something that's trained together and operates under unified command and control. That's not the UN. The UN comes in the aftermath to help keep things knit together, but it's rightly coalitions of the willing or alliances like NATO that would do the very tough, pointy spear stuff at the front end.
Yeah. We're discussing the role of peacekeeping missions in world conflicts. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. And let's go to Wesley in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Wesley.
Hi. I'm just curious as to why the United States, rather, you were just talking about this, but the UN or another nation, how come the pressure and the responsibility is always turned towards the United States for missions like this, where it really does have very little effect on the internal affairs of our country?
Bill Dirch?
Yeah, Wesley, the world's greatest superpower, and we have interests all over the world. And generally speaking, we have interests in peace and stability and the spread of democracy, the spread of market economics, and so forth, good governance. Because if you play that tape backwards, and let's say the rest of the world is decaying into the equivalent of Iraq and dictatorship and chaos and so forth, it's very clear if you do that, that that would not be in particularly in U.S. interest, not as an individual nation, not as someone with permeable borders, not as a country with a lot of trade relations. So the issue is, how far out in the other direction in maintaining order and preventing chaos do you need to go? And people disagree on how far you go. In terms of the UN, we've always been a prime mover, aside from being the, 25 to 30% contributor to the money to do this stuff. It was our initial initiative. The other countries kind of look to the United States to see, okay, where's Uncle Sam going? If Uncle Sam goes there, they tend to find sufficient interest to follow along. This is certainly the case with peacekeeping all through the Cold War. So, like it or not, we kind of have a leadership role, and the question is, how much of it do we do on our own, how much together with others, and how much do others do on their own?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Wesley. Following up on that, I mean, there are times when a peacekeeping mission would be a U.S.-led peacekeeping mission. Aren't there other times when the U.S. is part of a peacekeeping mission, but it is not led by the U.S.? I mean, how does that work? How are those decisions made?
Right now, we're part of the NATO-led Kosovo mission, KFOR. We have responsibility for one brigade area. I guess they're shrinking now almost to battalion size, but one brigade area. There are five brigade areas and then a central command. And that command has rotated. And that hasn't been an American commander. I'm not sure how frequently. Almost none at all. Primarily European. So there are precedents for that, certainly in NATO. In the example we all kind of like to forget, in Somalia, we did have troops who were supply troops who were nominally under the UN chain of command, but the deputy UN force commander was an American, and they really worked for him.
We may want to forget about Somalia, but we really have to look to Somalia perhaps as an example of when peacekeeping doesn't work and what went wrong there. What's the lesson from there?
I think part of the lesson from Somalia was that we quit too soon. The other lesson was that we were interfering in the dynamics of an internal squabble that we weren't willing to change substantially. But we were doing a pretty good job while we had U.S. forces there the first 5 months, but we were very eager to get out and go away. The mission was to be humanitarian assistance, and that's all. The problem when you get involved in a so-called purely humanitarian mission that involves intervention in a situation that is, in fact, political, civil war, you can do some good as long as you're there, but when you leave, it relapses. So it's like your entire investment is lost. There's a risk that you become dominated by the tyranny of sunk costs, right? We've invested this many people and this much money, we're going to kind of stick it out. What really is important, it's mostly important to understand what the underlying motives of the local parties are, what they're fighting for, you know, who's on first, what's on second, how they get along, how the culture works. And we kind of tend not to take enough time to do that. My rough guess is that if we had stayed a little longer in Somalia with a larger force, had handed off more gracefully to a stronger UN force instead of one that was half-formed, you wouldn't have had the initial attack on the UN that triggered the cascading response that led to Black Hawk Down.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have needed the special forces guys that conducted Black Hawk Down. And you would have been able, you would have had the strength in hand to deal with people like Idid, as we did in the first couple of months, which was beat him down, kiss and make up, go to the next step.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion in a moment. We're talking about America's involvement in international peacekeeping. It's Lynn Neary, Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the history and future of U.S. involvement in international peacekeeping. Our guest is Bill Deutsch of the Henry L. Stimson Center here in Washington. You're invited to join the discussion. How would you measure the success of a peacekeeping operation? And how broadly do you define American national security interest as it applies to peacekeeping? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Now joining us is Max Boot. He's a senior fellow of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also the author of Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. He's with us by phone from his home in Larchmont, New York. Thanks for being with us, Max.
Thanks for having me on.
We were talking earlier about the fact that America is the sole remaining a superpower, and that gives it a greater responsibility than other countries, perhaps, to take part in peacekeeping missions. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. The world looks to us for leadership, and you sort of see the irony now that many nations in the world were opposed to American intervention in Iraq and kept talking about how America should not be sticking its nose where it does not belong, but now many of those same nations are saying we should get involved in Liberia. So it's hard to go more than a month or two without somebody on the international scene calling for American intervention, just as it's hard to go a month or two without somebody on the international scene opposing American intervention. So we're sort of damned if we do and damned if we don't, but I think we have no choice but to wind up dealing with some of these hazardous situations around the world.
Bill Dirch and I, just before the break, were discussing some of the problems that arose in Somalia, a peacekeeping mission that was riddled with trouble. What distinguishes the success stories from the failures? I mean, let's look at, is there one peacekeeping mission that the U.S. has been involved in that you could discuss, which you would say is an example of a success?
I think there are two successful ones that are going on right now in Bosnia and Kosovo. The Bosnia one started in 1995. The Kosovo one started in 1999. In both cases, the long-term presence of U.S. and allied troops has kept ethnic cleansing from breaking out once again in the region, and has made it possible for both Bosnia and Kosovo to progress in a peaceful way. Perhaps not as far as some would like, but it's certainly much better than before those troops arrived. But I think what that shows is, very often, in order to achieve long-term success, you have to be willing to put your troops in for the long term. You can't just send them for a few months, as we did in Somalia, and then pull them out and expect that everything is going to work out okay. If you're going to be serious about it, you have to make that kind of long-term commitment, as we made in Bosnia and Kosovo. And that's why I'm concerned about the current intervention in Liberia, because I'm not sure if we're willing to make that kind of long-term commitment. And if we're not, I'm not sure what we're going to achieve by sending troops there for a few months.
Do you see similarities in Liberia between Liberia and Somalia, for example?
Quite possibly. I think in both instances there is a humanitarian imperative to intervene, but there's not enough of a national security imperative to compel us to make a long-term commitment. And therefore, what we're liable to do is to get in for a short time and then leave. And then the question is, are things going to be go back to the way they were after we left or not? It's hard to be too optimistic about the outcome unless we can set up some kind of international mechanism to administer a place like Liberia long-term and keep Charles Taylor or even some of his enemies from attaining power, and to create a semblance of stability after American troops leave.
All right, we have a lot of callers eager to get in on this discussion, so I'm going to go to the phones. Randall in Ventnor, New Jersey. Hello, welcome to Talk of the Nation. Randall?
Yeah, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Thanks for having me on your show. I'm a long-time listener, but a first-time caller. I just wanted to stress that this mission, if it goes on, will be one of the easiest peacekeeping mission America will have ever participated in. First and foremost, it will not require a large-scale deployment because it's a very small territory, and the people that will be opposing, the opposing parties are basically ragtag armies. So this will not require a large-scale deployment. It will not require a huge expenditure. Additionally, the Liberian population, the entire Liberian populace, overwhelmingly support American involvement, overwhelmingly welcome American participation. And so, you know, there is no similarity to, say, Iraq or Somalia, because you will have the population overwhelmingly on your side. You know, the situation down there is terrible, and the main instigator, Taylor, needs to be brought to face his indictment, and that is one of the key reasons why we should be there.
All right. Thanks for your call, Randall. And I'd like to hear both our guests perhaps respond to Randall's optimism about this, Bill Durch and Max Boot. Is it enough to hear that kind of optimism when you're making a decision to go in as a peacekeeper? Is enough? I just want you to react to what he seems to feel is the situation in Liberia, that it will be an easy situation. Bill Durch.
Lynn, none of these is easy. Because there's always great uncertainty as to who is really sincere about peace, who wants power, and how much they'll do to grab it. Liberia is 30% larger than Sierra Leone next door. It's got two-thirds of the population, so it's kind of a wash as to, you know, the comparative kinds of operations. But if you use a rule of thumb, if Sierra Leone ended up being sized right, you'd need about 15,000 or so peacekeepers to cover Liberia. The problem is the country's been in anarchy for so long that it's not just a matter of the individual citizens wanting to have peace. It's the question of the predators amongst them who exploit the country's resources and diamonds and have been jockeying for power for almost a generation now. They have to learn some new habits of mind and some new behaviors that are consistent with a peaceful and well-run country, and you need to find people to run it.
Okay, let's take one more call. Dana in Los Angeles. Hi, Dana.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to emphasize the point on the need for long-term engagement in these. I'm currently working with the UN mission in Kosovo. Hello?
Yes, hello. Go ahead.
Yes, with the UN mission in Kosovo, and there recently has been, you know, kind of a flurry of critique of the mission in the context of the discussions on Iraq. And one of the points that's absolutely clear is that the change that we are engaged in is a slow one, but it's a very real one. It takes time for people to recover from a war. It takes time to change a political system. It takes time to transform people's habits. That doesn't mean it can't be done. The fundamental question then is, are we willing to stay the course? And I think that point has been brought up, but I just wanted to emphasize it. It's absolutely central.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Dana. And I think, Max Boot, you were making that point before, that it's the commitment of time is maybe the most important, would you say? What about security on the ground? What does the security on the ground need to be before forces are sent in?
Well, the forces that go in will establish the security. And responding to the prior caller's message, I have no doubt that a relatively small force of American and allied soldiers will be able to grab control of Liberia very quickly and kick out Charles Taylor and his faction. But the real question is the one raised by the current caller, which is, what happens long term? What do you do once you get rid of the bad guys, which you can do relatively quickly, I think? Who's going to replace them? Charles Taylor's opposition is as thuggish as he is. So I think long term you need to have some kind of international protectorate, as we have in Kosovo or Bosnia, to administer the region. Well, I haven't heard any real plans for an international protectorate in Liberia, and I think we need to have that kind of planning and set up before we commit troops to the region. But the caller is absolutely right. It takes that long-term commitment, and it takes a commitment not only to the initial military entry but to long-term governance, and that's what we're engaged in right now in Iraq, where we're finding it's a very difficult long-term process.
But the forces we have there are not peacekeeping forces. I mean, these are the forces that were sent in as combat soldiers, were sent in to win.
They've transitioned from being a combat force to being a peacemaking and then ultimately peacekeeping force. I mean, unfortunately, right now in Iraq, there's not enough peace to keep, but hopefully they will establish peace, establish law and order, and allow the long-term development of Iraq. I stress this is a long-term process. Initially, President Bush gave the impression it was going to be a few months, the same impression that President Clinton gave about Bosnia and Kosovo. And in all those cases, that's a very misguided assumption. It's going to take years, possibly decades, to turn these countries around, and we'd better face up to that as we go into these engagements.
Do you send new troops in to be the peacekeepers and take out the troops who were the soldiers, the fighters?
Well, ideally, the problem is that we don't have enough troops to go around. In Iraq, you have units like the 3rd Infantry Division that did the bulk of the fighting, which are still very much in-country, have not been pulled out because the bulk of the U.S. Army is committed in various overseas operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, Kosovo, Korea, etc. There are no more troops available to to rotate in, and therefore that creates more of an imperative to get international troops in there to relieve some of the pressure on American troops. But it also makes the administration wary about undertaking too many new commitments at this time in places like Liberia, when our forces are stretched as thin as they already are by the existing commitments.
How do you rate the success of American military efforts in Afghanistan to keep the peace in Afghanistan?
It's not as good as I would hope, because we haven't made as much of a commitment as I would have liked. Part of that, I think, just has to do with what I just mentioned, which is that our forces are stretched very thin. We have about 10,000 troops in Afghanistan, and we just don't have any more that we can send in there. But as a result of that, Afghanistan is a very big country, over 20 million population. 10,000 troops are not able to keep the peace, and therefore you've had a rise of warlords. You've had the Taliban and Al-Qaeda still running around the provinces. The International Peacekeeping Force is barely able to keep a lid on Kabul. We haven't done nearly as much as I think we should do there to maintain and create law and order. But as I say, a lot of that just has to do with our limited resources.
Lynn, if I may?
Yes, go ahead.
And I'd like to follow up on Max's point. That's why we need international collaboration in these things, and why the U.S. government needs to make use of the existing international institutions, whether it's NATO or the U.N., that have the facilities, the procedures, and frankly the financing mechanisms to draw other countries together to undertake these things, and that we not like start from scratch and try and build our own little peacekeeping force, because the institutions are already out there. The Europeans and ourselves and the UN have been building them up now for several years to get better at doing some of these things. In terms of administering Liberia, yeah, that's one possibility, because they really haven't been run for a long time. I just want to remind folks that Liberia is 9 times the size of Kosovo and has about 50% more people in it. So, and UNMIC is a roughly $500 million proposition, plus the cost of peacekeeping. So, again, there's even if we internationalize it, there are going to be limits to how much we can do in how many places.
That was Bill Dirch. He's a senior associate at the Henry L. Stimson Center. And we've also been talking to Max Boot, a senior fellow of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. Thanks for joining us today, Max. I know you have to go now.
Thanks for having me on.
Max joined us by phone from his home in Larchmont, New York. Joining us now in Studio 3A is Chris Preble. He's the Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank here in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Thank you.
Now, I understand that you would favor a more limited role for American peacekeepers abroad than what we've been talking about, I think, thus far in the program.
Right. I might go even farther than that to say a limited role for U.S. troops abroad, because traditionally I've been very skeptical about peacekeeping operations. I think that both guests, both Max Boot and Bill Dirch, have pointed out that to succeed in peacekeeping takes a very, very, very long-term commitment, and that the conditions for success rarely exist. And given both of those factors, and given the fact that we are stretched to the breaking point, something that Max alluded to, our military forces are already deployed in far too many places, many of which do not contribute to our own American national security. Clearly, Liberia does not pose a threat to the United States, and therefore it is a purely humanitarian mission, and therefore, in my mind, is really a luxury that we simply cannot afford.
If you'd like to join our discussion on the role of peacekeeping missions, particularly the role of the U.S. in peacekeeping missions in world conflicts, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Chris, what about moving off of Liberia for a moment? What about Iraq? What should be going on in Iraq? What's the transition that should be taking place in your mind right now in Iraq? And is it, again, a limited one? Should we be thinking of getting those troops out now? How long should we make a commitment to Iraq?
We are not transitioning to an Iraqi authority composed of Iraqis responsible for governing Iraq. And because we have not moved in that direction, the presumption is, rightly or wrongly, that the United States will stay. I think this does two things. It discourages those Iraqis who wish to work with the United States on the understanding that they will gain title to their country again. At the same time, it emboldens those critics who, even from the very beginning, even people who weren't necessarily Saddam Hussein loyalists, who always assumed that the United States' goal was to subjugate the Iraqis, rightly or wrongly, and I think most of that is a wrong impression, but it will discourage the genuine reformers and embolden the most radicalized elements in this country. We need to be transitioning to an Iraqi government led by Iraqis.
All right, let's take a call from Scott in Miami, Florida. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Go ahead.
Okay, yes. Candy, thank you for taking the call.
Right, go ahead. Go ahead with your comment.
I'm sorry, yes. Well, the question as far as peacekeeping missions, I personally see that as something as an inevitability for the United States. Just very quickly, in the last few years, we've seen us go to reactive, which was Afghanistan. We've seen us go to preemptive, which is Iraq. And now we're being, I look at this as like invitational. The debate that I'm hearing in the comments that I'm hearing seem to confirm that. My question would be at this point, if we accept, quote-unquote, this international invitation to become, quote-unquote, peacekeepers, something that's rather new to the vocabulary here in the first part of the 21st century in national ideology, what are indeed we going to face? The debate is not just going in, but how long we're going to be there, and how are we going to unravel a complex situation such as that to our benefit? There has to be a degree of, you know, of national benefits in that for us to pursue that, and I'd like to hear some comments along those lines.
Thanks for your question. I imagine, Chris Preble, that you would probably agree with much of what the caller just said.
Unfortunately, I agree, but I would disagree with a key point, it seems to me. I refuse to accept that any policy, foreign policy or otherwise, is inevitable. I believe that the United States should retain control over its foreign policy, that our foreign policy should be directed to protecting and defending our interests. The difference between the three cases he mentioned, Afghanistan posed a genuine threat to the United States because the Taliban was giving aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda. The threat posed to the United States from Iraq was a debatable point, one in which reasonable people can disagree. There is no threat posed to the United States by what is happening in Liberia. That must be a condition, a criteria for determining when and where the United States becomes involved abroad.
Is there ever a humanitarian justification for peacekeeping?
Rarely.
Rarely?
Rarely.
Where have you seen it? In what cases? When there's genocide? Or
The problem with cases of genocide, and the two most obvious from the 1990s, were the allegations of genocide, more accurately ethnic cleansing, in former Yugoslavia, and the actual genocide that took place in Rwanda. The problem with genocide is it's often not clear that genocide is taking place until it has already happened. And events or incidents that appear to be simply random acts of violence, even organized violence against groups, spin out of control. And it's very hard to distinguish between those kinds of things.
All right. We're talking about American peacekeeping efforts abroad. We're going to continue the discussion after the break. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tomorrow, we'll check back in with the men and women who want to challenge George Bush for the White House in 2004. A look at the Democratic presidential candidates. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we continue our discussion on peacekeeping. My guests are Bill Dirch of the Henry L. Stimson Center and Chris Preble, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Just before the break, Bill Dirch, we were talking about humanitarian justifications for peacekeeping missions. And I just wanted to hear your take on that. We were talking with Chris Preble about that. What's your take on it?
Well, humanitarian intervention is always a dangerous enterprise and probably something to be undertaken as kind of a last resort, which, of course, is going to make it more dangerous because the longer you wait, the harder the problem is going to be. And, yes, it can be hard to recognize genocide sometimes until after the fact, except that when you're there watching it, it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly. It was much clearer to us that there was a serious problem going on in Bosnia, for example, long before we took serious military action to stop it cold, a three-year period in which we basically tracked it. There were several weeks and months of lead-up to the genocide in Rwanda, where it was clear that something really bad was going to happen, and then for months something bad was happening, and it turned out from the particular geometry of that conflict, it probably could have been brought to a halt relatively easily. Other places, not so easy. Congo, very difficult problem at the moment. The problem with the definition that I heard the other speaker use for American interests, it's basically tactical. You see a threat, you whack a threat. But it's very hard to look forward and prevent threats from growing out of control in the first place. From keeping places from unraveling. It's kind of a, we sally forth from the gated community when the noise outside the gates becomes too loud to bear. Ultimately, what is designed to be an inexpensive foreign policy can become very expensive if the whole outside world becomes really, really rowdy, which was the point I was making earlier in the hour.
Let's take a call. Peter in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I think this is a regional problem, as some people consider it to be only Liberia's problem. And I want you to consider a scenario. Let's say if U.S. does not intervene and Liberia and the entire region continues to degenerate, let's say the entire region becomes a breeding ground for terrorism. Wouldn't that affect the United States also? And I see your speaker just said that the longer you wait, the bigger the problem will be. And I think if the United States had intervened in 1990, then we wouldn't be having this discussion right now. But since the U.S. did not intervene, the problem extended to Sierra Leone, to Guinea, to Ivory Coast, and who knows where else. So I believe that with all the intervention of the United States now, it's going to be a big mistake because it's going to degenerate into further chaos. And besides, we need somebody to come in to neutralize these forces.
All right. Thanks for your call, Pete.
Let me make this last point, please.
Okay.
Charles Taylor is our problem, but he's not the only problem. When he's gone, there are other warlords in there, and we need a neutralizing force that will come in to separate these forces so that we can have a genuine election and have a democratic government in Liberia.
Thanks so much for your call, Peter. I think Peter made some really interesting and excellent points there touched on what we were just discussing, and that is anticipating what the problems may be before they occur and what the threats to national security will ultimately be for the United States. And Chris Preble, favor a more limited role in terms of peacekeeping, what is your reaction to that? I mean, how do you make those kinds of decisions? How do you anticipate these kinds of things before it's gotten to a point where the region becomes out of control and there are threats?
I think that by focusing a regional, there are regional solutions to this problem, and they have not been executed completely. There are West African nations that are interested in controlling this problem, and they're calling on the United States to lead this process. But why is it the United States is always called in? The question about terrorism being or failed states, as the case is often made, being a breeding ground for terrorism, I think we need to distinguish between what types of chaos and threat. We know the type of terrorism that threatens the United States. It attacked us on September 11th, and we know where al-Qaeda operates. Al-Qaeda does not operate in Liberia.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us today, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris Preble is the Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And let me just ask you one more question, Bill Dirch. In situations like Afghanistan and Iraq, where America has played a role in dismantling an existing regime, does it then become the United States' obligation to restore the peace in those countries? Without question, would you say? Or does it need to call in an international force to help it?
Well, frankly, we're bigger than any other international force there is around. We can certainly get help from others, but in a large situation like Afghanistan or Iraq, we're the biggest dog on the block. And if we break it, we own it for the time being until we get it fixed. And if we don't fix it, others are going to flow into that gap and fix it for us, and we probably won't like how they fix it. So that's the dilemma we've got. It's a hard job to do. It, again, is probably something that was better done sooner rather than later. Few of these things get easier as time goes on. The question is, do you have the data and the wisdom to know which one of these problems is going to bite you later on if you don't do something about it. To that extent, you know, Chris Preble has a point. We don't have really, really good crystal balls, and what we really need is a better way of assessing situations and predicting where they're going to go and developing tools to intervene early. And I don't mean by military means. I mean by the whole toolkit at our disposal, whether it's political or economic or diplomatic, cultural, social, what have you.
Bill Dirch is the senior associate at the Henry L. Stimson Center. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bill.
Thank you, Lynn.